behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. As always, we are joined by our super producer, Dylan Fagan. We'll see if a nickname pops up here.
I think there could be some fun ones for this one.
I think there can. This is going to be a little bit different in comparison to many of our other topics. We are talking about a specific historical experiment, something maybe the corporate world would call a big swing.
Oh, yeah, with a twist.
With one heck of a twist. I guess the best way to say it, and not to bleed over into too many other shows, but the best way to say it is that conspiracies can occur in any realm or discipline, and cars are no different. And in our one of our other shows, you've been a guest where you discussed some various cover-ups or skullduggery that occurred in the automotive world.
Yeah, sure we have. And, you know, you should go ahead and plug your own show because it's a great show. So go ahead.
Very kind. Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is our show that applies critical thinking to conspiracy theories and, you know, fringe reports. And we get into some weird stuff, but you might be surprised, ladies and gentlemen, how often these two seemingly vastly different shows find themselves on the same page.
Yeah, we talked about water-powered cars, and what else did we talk about? I think maybe some we had thrown around these ideas, so if they weren't episodes, forgive me, but we talked about pavement that wouldn't wear out.
Yep.
We talked about like maybe a carburetor that it could be tuned to get, you know, for cars to get 100 miles per gallon back in the 1950s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of ideas that have been thrown out there. I can't remember how many of these we actually laid down the recording for, though.
The trolley systems being bought out.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, the trolley car scandal.
Yeah. Now, I believe that was GM, right?
Yeah, that was GM.
And they did get found guilty in court.
And a bunch of other oil companies as well.
Right,
but that's the real thing. That really happened.
Yeah, that really happened.
What are some of the other weird ones that are tied into this? Have we covered? Oh, I don't even know if we should touch on this or not. The city.
Oh,
the entire city.
We may have mentioned it, but it's definitely in a. You did a piece on it. For the history folks.
I did, yeah, but that was way back in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Not that anything's changed, really, with
right.
it. But this is all stuff we're going to touch on today.
Yeah, and that show is Stuff You Missed in History Class. You can, if you are an intrepid investigator, you can find the episode we're talking about.
This is, you know, I feel like so far I'm walking this delicate balance. I don't know what you want me to reveal yet or not, because there is some stuff to reveal.
Right.
You know, during this podcast. So I feel like I'm kind of on the line here. So let's do this. How about we just jump right into it?
All right.
Let's start this episode, and I'll try not to open my big mouth. And if I do, maybe we'll cut it out. Maybe we won't. Maybe we'll leave it in, and that'll be the reveal.
Oh, but it'll be perfect, because this is a pretty strange and exciting thing. Because of all these car-related conspiracies or cover-up allegations that we have named, ladies and gentlemen, we have yet to touch on one. One theory that we have never addressed in all the years we've been doing car stuff, and that is the story that as World War II loomed on the horizon, the legendary automotive tycoon Henry Ford proposed and built a radical new vehicle that he thought would change the state of manufacturing forever.
The hemp car. Now, a car entirely built out of hemp, right?
Right.
So, I mean, I guess we're talking about marijuana, right? I mean, sort of. There's a difference, and I think you probably know the difference between hemp and marijuana, right?
Right. So when we first learned of this interesting anomaly here, or this interesting legend, right, my initial reaction was, well, Henry Ford's an eccentric individual, so if someone were to try to do that, I could absolutely see him doing it. And when we ran into this, you know, we found it on these less than reputable websites, for instance. And one of the things that you might envision is somebody who is, you know, like a stoner who is going, yeah, man, they're covering up, you know, like how useful marijuana is and stuff like that. But there is there are some interesting differences between the kind of hemp that would be involved in this project and the kind of drug that people would smoke, even though they're the same species.
And playing into this, before you begin your description of the two, is that Ford has kind of a history of experimenting with other materials for the purposes that he needed. So let's say the Spanish moss for the packing of the seat, instead of the fiber fill stuff that they normally use.
Yeah.
And that, you know, kind of backfired on him as well. But that's like one early, early example that I can think of. So there's a couple of those. And then even into modern day, so if you're looking at this, you know, as history, which we are today, modern day, you know that Ford is experimenting with a lot of different materials to make new types of plastics and body materials and make things stronger and lighter, et cetera. So there's a little bit of something in the back of your head that lets you think like, yeah, this could be a thing. He could have tried to build an entire car made out of hemp.
Right, right. And at first it sounds crazy, but then there's that moment. Moment of reflection where you think, wow.
Like he's a crazy bastard, that guy.
So,
but I say that lovingly.
Yes, yes, with no shortage of immense respect.
Of course.
Which, Scott calling someone a bastard is about the highest compliment that he's ever paid.
Are we going to have to beep that? Are we going to have to get that out of there? I don't know. We'll see.
It'll just sound worse if we beep it. So usually when people say hemp, what they are talking about are strains of what's called cannabis sativa that have been bred specifically for fiber. And this fiber could be used in clothing and construction to make oils, other substances. The main point is it doesn't have a large amount of THC, so it doesn't create that feeling people have of being high after they consume marijuana. Now, the other stuff, pot, weed, tea, Uncle Milroy's elbow medicine, whatever you want to call it.
That's too long for Dylan's nickname, by the way.
Dylan Uncle Milroy Fagan?
Yeah.
Not bad. But you know, whatever people call it, that's just a slang term used to describe the strains of essentially the same plant that are specifically bred for these resinous glands and these leaves or buds that contain a lot of THC.
Okay, so you handed me a note earlier that said that the difference between these two is really semantic, really.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so not only hemp and pot come from the same genus, but they're the same species, but they're bred for different purposes, really.
Right, exactly.
So one is bred for more of a, I guess material science type application. You know, with fibers, so they could be woven into rope or cloth. We see, you know, at all these music festivals, you find bags and sandals and things that, you know, have been woven from hemp. And of course, along with that goes the speech that, you know, this is a fiber, this is a plant that should be, planted on every available space that we have. You know,
right.
It should be – everybody should be growing this because it's so useful for so many things.
Right. And there is an agricultural argument, a very old agricultural argument that's been going on. But there's also – when we talk about the semantic stuff, it also takes us into the legal world, which gets murky very, very quickly because here in the United States, there are multiple state-level definitions of what – is or isn't a legal use of this species.
Yeah, and I'll be honest with you. At this point in our history, I'm lost as to where it's legal, where it's not legal, who can grow it, how much you can grow, how much you can carry, how much, all that stuff. I completely have lost track. Early on, it was easy enough that, you know, Colorado could do this. You know, and their stores, right. And you know that was about it, and then it spread from there. I think Colorado was the first, but that's the more recreational use type stuff that we're talking about,
right? Exactly. And so, as the U.S. has been moving away from marijuana prohibition, states are scrambling in a relatively non-unified effort to figure out definitions of what would count as marijuana, the drug, and what would count as hemp, the agricultural product. And that phrase is very important, not just to us, but to Henry Ford. So it's no secret that the federal government for a very long time opposed products with hemp components due to the bad image, the association with marijuana. And you can kind of see where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would be – if there's a thing that can also be a drug or you can make rope with it, and maybe a car? Who knows? Well, we know, and we'll tell you in a little bit.
Yeah.
But it becomes very difficult from a legal standpoint, from a law enforcement standpoint, to keep your eye on every sparrow pot grower wise.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
To check every level of THC from every crop that is being grown out there.
Right. And then there are a lot of people who, as you said, champion the idea of hemp and tell these stories like, oh, George Washington farmed it. It's so
sure.
It has a million uses. And
it's true. It does.
Yeah. Well, and what about all the great rock music and stand up comedy?
Oh, yeah. And artists, you know,
yeah.
A lot of art would not be created without, you know,
jazz
marijuana.
Cigarettes.
Yeah, jazz cigarettes.
That was
sure.
My favorite one I learned. Or stoner food. And for that matter, what about the cars? When we get into this, we have to start out by saying there is so much misinformation out there about Henry Ford.
Yeah.
He's a living legend. Well, he was a larger-than-life figure who became a legend after he passed away. A brilliant man. He was an acolyte of Thomas Edison, who is a I'll go out and say it. Thomas Edison's a bit of a stone-cold bastard.
Oh, that's two times in one episode.
We'll
we're going to have to bump this up to PG-13.
We might have to.
That's, okay, we'll try to back that down. How about that?
We'll try to back that
down. Keep it PG.
And as we discussed before, it's speculated that he even played some part in the creation of what we refer to as the Weekend.
The Weekend. Oh, that's right. We had a discussion about how he created the Weekend so he could get more productivity.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, there's a whole story behind the
Weekend.
It's
pretty interesting.
Yeah, it really is.
Also, so he could get some customers.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, his own people. They didn't have time to buy cars.
Mm, but also, he, you know, wasn't a perfect person by any means. He had some very strict, uncompromising standards, and sometimes, of course, he could be a little bit of a loon,
as we've documented.
So, of course, when we hear the story, we think, "Oh, that makes sense. This guy is uber bonkers at times."
Yeah, and again, here we're talking about the town. Here's the town that I was mentioning before, and I know we're not letting out any secrets here yet,
sure.
But it's part of the story. So, if you want to think about like one of his craziest, ventures.
Yes,
it would be Fordlandia. And the story of Fordlandia is fascinating. It really is. It's really, really, really interesting. It started around 1928. It was abandoned by 1934. So in that short time, he kind of had to give up on this dream. But the idea was he was going to employ, I think it was in Brazil, right? It's off a river in Brazil.
Yeah, it's in the Amazon.
Yeah, and it's just this desolate area that he was hoping to employ 10,000 people in the, I guess it would be the American rubber industry, really, in a way.
Right.
I mean, this would be like a remote plant that would produce this raw material for him to use in his factories that he would need for auto production.
It's like a rubber plantation meets an idealized Norman Rockwell-esque town.
Yeah, and it never really got off the ground. And again, Stuff You Missed in History Class did a full episode on this back in 2010. And then I joined them for kind of a guest host spot in 2012 where we talked about Ford himself. And, of course, Fordlandia came up at some point during that show. It was a two-part episode.
Yeah, it was a great one, too.
I think in the second part is where we discuss Fordlandia, but I could be wrong. Maybe part one.
Well, my favorite part about Fordlandia, because it does sound interesting and maybe a little bit self-important, right, to name it Fordlandia.
Sure.
But I think you've earned that right if you're building a town in the Amazon. The thing that makes it weird is that he forced the people who lived there, the employees and their families, to engage in this, his idea of what the ideal American small town should be like.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a dry town, no drinking.
Yeah.
There was a baseball team. People had certain codes of dress they were expected to adhere to. It was like, you know that movie, The Stepford Wives?
Yeah.
It was trying to create like a Stepford existence.
You know, this all plays back into where he was born. I think he's born out in the country, way out in the country somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And he later had great guilt over his own invention. He felt that he had somehow destroyed something that he held so close to his heart.
Right.
By allowing I don't know the best way to say this. I'll have to go back and listen to the way that we framed this before.
Uh-huh.
But he came from this little bucolic area.
Yeah,
you know, beautiful.
Greenfield Township.
Greenfield Township, okay. And then moved to the city to do his work in Dearborn, you know, et cetera. And along the way, there were a lot of steps along the way, but ended up in the city. and then realized that there's this pristine, beautiful countryside out there that he was then allowing people from the city to travel to in their cars that were spewing, pollutants, really.
Right.
And
yes.
He had this guilt that he had created a machine that was going to somehow sully that area. It was going to make it, something not as pure as it was prior to, back when he was a kid, I guess.
Right. The times that were changing.
Yeah, so he had this strange, I did this, but I'm also guilty of this.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes sense that he was trying to recreate that and keep it pristine, keep it, keep it clean there, I guess. And I think they even had rules like no dancing. And
yeah, it was very, that's right.
It was very Puritan, I think. That's kind of the general focus of this whole town.
And that sounds kind of like a set of rules that, my cynicism is coming out here, Scott. But often when people make those sorts of rules, it's because it's very easy to make rules that you don't have to obey. I'm not saying that Henry Ford was out, drinking all day and dancing all night, but I'm saying he didn't live in Fordlandia.
No, he didn't, but I honestly believe that this character was somebody who probably didn't drink, wasn't a, go late, get to bed late in the evening and party kind of guy.
No, I don't think so.
I think he was a, early to bed, early to rise guy who was a hard worker,
pretty
industrious.
Focused.
He had some, some bonkers views of the world.
Yeah.
And again, all of this, everything. And much, much more, by the way, that we're not discussing here today. All of this plays into the idea that, it's possible that this character could have decided he was going to build a hemp car, a car made entirely out of hemp.
Right. And that's the question. Did he really make a car entirely out of hemp? We'll tell you the answer after a word from our sponsor.
Oh, Ben, you left us with a real cliffhanger here. So what really happened?
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you can scoot back from the edge and continue to use the rest of your seat. The answer is this. No, he did not make a car entirely out of hemp. That's a bummer, right?
But yeah, well, sort of.
That's the truth. Well, first, just to be clear, you can't make an entire car out of hemp. You have rubber for tires, you have an engine that needs to be built with something that is not hemp.
Well, sure. Yeah. There's of course metal and rubber components.
Sure.
and of course there's all the fluids and stuff that would have to be somehow contained, and you can't do that in something made out of hemp, right?
Right.
I don't think.
And I think most people know that. Just want to establish
so,
that.
Well, of course. Yeah, that's logical. But so what we're talking about really is the body shell that's made out of
.
I said that weird. The body shell that was made out of that's the emphasis on the wrong syllable thing.
Right.
So he made the body shell out of hemp was the claim.
That's the claim.
The claim, but what really happened was he made it out of an entirely different material altogether.
And what was that?
Soybeans.
So there is a grain of truth in this story. He did make what people called a soybean car, and it may have actually contained some amount of hemp. This is not just a story made from thin air.
So it's a mixture. Right, because
most likely,
because soybeans they have. If you look at the chemical makeup of a soybean, I had it somewhere here, but there's a breakdown of how much protein is there, how much soluble fiber,
right,
how much unsoluble fiber, just how much moisture, all that. There's oils involved, so soybeans themselves can't make what we're talking about here. This is a plastic product that they made,
right?
And plastics, if you think back to when this was happening, which would have been the late 1930s, early 1940s, that was a relatively new thing.
Yeah, it was a new thing. People were still figuring it out. We hadn't yet reached that phase where. Do you remember the movie The Graduate?
Yes.
Isn't there a conversation in The Graduate somewhere where this guy's like, "Plastics, my boy"?
Oh yeah.
They were still new, so we weren't even at that stage where your relatives or some family friend will tip you off, but we're at the stage where the early adopters are beginning to understand just how far plastic can go as a technology. And Henry Ford was very much a progress-oriented person, the great experimenter. He had no problem dismissing the status quos of his day, especially if he felt they were limiting progress. So let's go to where Scott started here, the late 1930s. He saw several problems looming on the horizon. One, steel had, at the time, some real issues, some limitations as a building material for automobiles. Converting ore to steel, it's a complex operation. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, he has to work with other companies.
Yeah.
Which is not always his favorite thing.
No, that's why he builds his own companies to supply his company or supply his factories.
Right. And he began thinking, what else could I do? What are alternative materials?
Yeah,
could you build his car with something else?
So here's what happened in late 1930s, I guess. Henry visited, or he made a visit to his own village that he created, you know, to train, you know, prospective engineers and designers and all that. He had this place. It was like a tech school almost, really. And it was the Deerfield Village Trade School. And this is where he learned about a crop that they were experimenting with at the time, which was, of course, something that was kind of obscure and irrelevant in the West at the time, which it was soybeans.
Right. People didn't know very much about soybeans. The average American citizen wouldn't. Henry Ford, however, became obsessed. Man, he loved soybeans. He was probably one of the first Americans to drink soy milk on a regular basis, which we're just going to add to more of our strange facts about Henry Ford.
Yeah.
Maybe we should just make a book on this.
Well, maybe.
He had a lunch at the 1934 World's Fair where he served an all-soy menu. We're talking soy crackers, soy cheese, soy milk, straight-up soy beans, and so on.
Yep, and not just that, Ben. I've got one little surprise for you here.
What's that?
This is a little bit later in the story, but I'm going to show you a picture of him. It's a famous picture. He's celebrating his birthday in 1941, his 78th birthday. So this is jumping ahead a little bit, we'll come back in time.
Yeah.
He's wearing this this kind of light-colored suit, and he's sitting on a bale of hay mm-hmm. out in a field.
Yeah.
That's a soybean suit.
A soybean suit.
It's a suit made out of soybeans. So this guy is eating soybeans. He's drinking soybean milk. He's wearing a suit made out of soybeans. He's all in. He's all in on this, right?
Yes.
And this is only a few years after he learned about it, but he is a soybean fan. He probably had, you know, banners in his room that said soybeans, hurrah, or whatever, you know. So excited about it, and he's learning about this stuff from these young engineers and designers and technicians that are working on these labs in this place that he's created for them to eventually come to work for him.
And that's so strange. That suit is blowing me away.
Yeah, it's kind of
strange. I wear a soybean suit.
It's an iconic photo. I mean, you can look it up, and if you just look up Ford soybean suit 1941, mm-hmm. you'll find it. It's a funny photo. And you see him in that suit a lot.
I mean, I wonder if he had many. Was he wearing all soy clothes?
You know, I would guess that this is probably one of a kind. I would think.
Yeah, how would you? I'm interested to learn about the process there. Well, this proves the point even further, because he believed in the versatility of soybeans and he didn't think it needed to be limited solely to foods. In hopes of building a cheaper, more durable, and lighter car, he turned to the soybean, and he originally enlisted the help of a stylist named E.T. Gregory. Yeah. Remember that name, folks. It comes up later.
Yeah, that's right. And so this project, okay, the project goes on, right? And he's kind of helping him develop this thing, but he's reportedly dissatisfied with the work that he produced on this team. So he said he's going to hand this off to another guy. His name is Lowell E. Overly. And his background, he had a background prior to working in Ford Soybean Laboratory as a tool and die designer. So he's a tool and die guy, but he's brought in to work on this soybean project. So that's kind of an unusual mix for him.
Yeah.
Probably haven't found the right guy yet. There's another guy that they need to kind of tap into his ideas, his resources for this project.
Right. And one thing that Overly did very well, which is a skill that that more people should have, mm-hmm. that we can all find useful, is Overly said, well, you know what? I'm not an expert. I'm not going to pretend to be the expert at this part, so let me find someone who knows the business of chemistry. And he found a chemist named Robert A. Boyer. And Boyer is the real, I guess, the real heroic figure in our story.
Yeah, and I've got a little bit of a tie-in to this guy, a little bit of personal knowledge.
That's right.
Just a little bit.
We talked about this off-air,
Not a lot, but tell you what, let's take a word from our sponsor right now, and we'll come back with it.
And we're back. Scott, got to keep stop pushing people to the edge of their seats for the Jab Breaks.
Well, this is a distant at best, you know, degrees of Henry Ford for me. It's as close as I can get, really, I suppose. For a short while, in the late 1980s and early 1990s, my mom dated a guy. She's divorced. She dated a guy who was Lee Iacocca's pilot for Chrysler at the time.
Weird.
He was like a, you know, the Gulfstream jet pilot or whatever. The guy's name was Thomas Boyer. And Thomas Boyer is the son of Robert A. Boyer, this chemist that worked with Henry Ford. And so I heard of this way back in the 1980s when he was talking about his dad, because his dad was still around at the time. His father passed away in 1989. This Robert Boyer did, the chemist. So he was still around when I was talking with him. And we had gone to the Henry Ford, which is a museum there in town, the Henry Ford. And there were – I think it was a film strip that had him, this guy Thomas Boyer.
Yeah.
On Henry Ford's lap on Christmas Day, like a film, bizarre. He's like, "That's me." He had no idea it was going to be there.
That's crazy.
But his family was invited because Henry Ford had kind of taken this guy under his wing. This Robert Boyer, and of course, you know, being his family, of course, he was invited to some of the Ford family functions and holidays and things like that at the Ford mansion.
That's got to be cool.
And this guy was pretty fascinating. He had things like, you know, food patents and on preservatives, and he had the patent on Bacos, which are those bacon bits that you shake on your salad.
Right.
You know, they're not real bacon. Just an interesting character all around, but he was taken in by Ford because he had what Ford called a keen, active mind when he first met him as a youngster in this Deerfield Village place. But he brought him in and let him work closely with him on the soybean project because he felt he was the one that could do it. And he did. He ended up making what we know as like the plastic panels for automobiles.
Yeah, the soybean car was unveiled by Henry Ford on August 13th, 1941 at a community festival called Dearborn Days. Ford was very active in this local community stuff. And
again, can I interrupt?
Yeah, please.
There's more iconic photos that you need to see here because this is one of Henry Ford that we've talked about in the past.
Yeah.
Him swinging an axe head at the trunk of a car,
uh-huh,
which doesn't leave a dent.
That was the soybean car.
In 1941. That's unbelievable. So, you know, in the 80s when we were kind of like, you know, remarking how incredible it was that these Saturn cars could have a shopping cart bump into the door, and remember their television commercials.
Yeah,
there were a lot of things like that happening to Saturn car doors in these commercials, where they would, you know, flex in and then flex out, no damage done, right?
Yeah,
and it was supposedly revolutionary, but here's Ford doing it back in 1941. So Henry was on top of things, and probably just at the right time too, but they didn't know it.
Right, because not everyone is that attuned to the future. You know, this guy really does have his finger on the pulse. Let's talk a little bit about the actual car. So it has a frame. It's made of tubular steel. It has 14 of these plastic panels attached to it. The car weighs 2,000 pounds, which makes it 1,000 pounds lighter than a steel car. The plastic window, the windows are plastic. It has a 60 horsepower Ford flathead V8, and the thing about those plastic panels, this is interesting, Scott. We know it was called a soybean car. They would have called it a hemp car if hemp was the biggest ingredient, but we do not know the exact ingredients of these plastic panels because today no record of the formula exists.
Yeah, and you know what else? They can't go back and somehow determine what was in those panels, you know, via chemistry, because someone destroyed the plastic car, right? And so
yes.
It's an interesting twist on this whole thing,
yep.
Right? So after they were on display, you know, they were revealed at, what was it, the Dearborn Days or whatever you said there. And then also the Michigan State Fair, it made another appearance there.
The only two appearances.
Oh, so that's the only two.
Yeah.
So after that Michigan State Fair appearance, the car disappeared and was destroyed. It was and this is not like you know, something we're making. It was destroyed, and we know it was destroyed.
Right.
But the person that destroyed it, that's maybe another little twist on this whole thing.
So according to Overly, the toolmaker who was taking over and contacted Boyer, the person who ordered the soybeans car's destruction was E.T. Gregory, the stylist who originally had the project.
So the guy that the project was taken away from him, I guess if you want to say twice, it was taken away twice. It was taken away the first time because he wasn't quite cutting it.
Yeah.
It went to Overly, mm-hmm. and then from Overly it went on to Boyer, mm-hmm. and then Gregory probably still had a little bit of sour grapes about the whole thing and decided to just destroy it. I mean, why would you not hang on to something like that? Or why would you not at least maintain the formula? Because this is a proven winner. This is something that that they could have kind of held their back pocket.
Yeah,
even if not right now, but you know, let's bring this out later. And I tell you, whenever they displayed this thing, whenever they swung that axe at that car, mm-hmm. and it didn't dent, and they jumped on the panel and it didn't dent, it was remarkable. This product, people were astounded. You know, the crowd went crazy.
And even if it was just a novelty, it would be even if you know the specifics of the material science made it impractical to produce or something, then it would still be a great thing to put in a museum. Yeah. I feel like Indiana Jones. It belongs in a museum.
Yeah, like in a big crate where there's a huge like storage area, you know,
top
being wheeled
men.
Into. Yeah. but you know, here's the thing. Like, if they could only have a piece of that remaining, they could analyze what's in there and figure out how much of that was soybean, how much was hemp, how much was other material, you know, whatever types of fiber they used or whatever. I mean, it's an interesting product, really. And
yeah.
I wish they had taken the time to keep a sample of it, or at least – you know, a better search for the formula that was created by Robert Boyer.
There might be something there in his notes from his estate, or there might be something. Mm. There might be something out there. You never know.
Maybe passed on to his son Thomas.
Maybe.
Hmm.
Maybe you should.
Maybe I should reestablish that contact.
You should write back to him. That'd be a weird letter, my friend.
That would be like, hey, remember me from 30 years ago?
So okay, here's one thing we can do though. We can explore the speculation people have about the formula. So you'll see some articles that claim the formula for these miracle plastic panels contained many ingredients, including soybeans, wheat, flax, and wait for it, I'm kidding, hemp. So the man who was instrumental in creating the car, Lowell Overly, claims that this was soybean fiber in a phenolic resin with formaldehyde used in the impregnation. However, it's possible that only Boyer had the real scoop on the ingredients.
Now, I have a question for you. Is it possible that the cloth backing used for this, because it had to be it was impregnated into a cloth? Is that right? That could have been all hemp.
You know, that's an interesting point, Scott.
It might not have had to been in the chemical makeup of the actual plastic itself. It could have been that the fabric that it was built on, I suppose.
Yeah.
That could have been the hemp, element to this whole thing. I just now thought of that.
I didn't think of that.
Instead of being part of the mixture, it's the base material.
That's you know what? That's a very good idea.
I don't know. Well, I guess we'll never know.
Yes, unfortunately, we will never know. But the good news there, the silver lining on the cloud for those of us out in the audience or out in the world who really want there to be some kind of truth to the hemp car story, you can hold on to that part. It might be a hemp-assisted car.
Hemp-assisted. Okay, I like it.
That sounds like a heck of a way to get pulled over.
Well, yeah.
So the big question then, or one of our final questions then, is if this stuff was cool, if, as we said, it really did work in that it did the stuff Henry Ford wanted it to do, mm-hmm. then what happened? Why are you not driving and listening to this podcast in a soybean car right now?
Well, we have better alternatives now for plastic, right? I mean, plastic technology moved on from that point. This is the early days, I believe. I think this is the right answer, right?
Yeah.
Because it seems like, this is the first thing where we found, like, okay, it has the right chemical, composure to make. Well, I'm no chemist by any means, obviously. We can just
neither of us are chemists.
No, we've determined that throughout this whole podcast. I'm no chemist. but it seems like this is a great starting point. But, of course, everything is going to advance, and we're talking about decades and decades and decades of advancement before we saw some real reliable plastic material that could be used in the exterior of automobiles that would have the properties that we needed, the resilient mm-hmm. or even impregnable materials. Is that the right word? I think that you could impregnate with color.
Yeah.
So that, they might not have to receive as many layers of paint or different types of paint.
Right.
You could adhere – different types of trim and molding to them, and not have that break at the same time. You know, that they kind of match the flexibility of that material.
There's another point too.
Oh, what's that?
I don't know if we mentioned this. Temperature variation.
Oh, yeah.
That's a huge one.
Yeah. How many old Pontiacs did we see with those, you know, those huge side trim pieces underneath? I think it was the old Bonnevilles, maybe.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
That would have just wavy material on the side from about the middle point of the driver door and passenger door down all the way to the ground.
Right.
And it was just like it just couldn't it couldn't withstand the heat of, let's say, being in the reflection of a building, or it couldn't stand the cold and then the heat. So let's say that it would be extremely cold in the north and 20 below or whatever, and then in the summertime it's 110.
Right.
It's tough to create a plastic that can stand up to that.
Yeah, and it's even tougher when we consider that it's not just a matter of whether the material remains stable. Temperature-wise, many plastics that would be otherwise fine, or several plastics that would be otherwise fine, can't be included in these sorts of endeavors or projects because when the heat rises, they emit dangerous chemicals.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get you.
That new car smell that's slowly killing you, those are the safe ones.
So it's not so much just holding shape. It's also that it's giving off stuff that you don't necessarily want around you as your body, yeah. I guess. It would be dangerous.
A high degree of VOCs, and those are responsible in some way for the new car smell, which a lot of people love. And I'm exaggerating when I say it's slowly killing you. You would have to lock yourself in a car and huff a lot of that for it to harm you.
Probably right in the heat of summer, too.
Yeah.
I mean, so that it's off-gassing as much as possible.
Right.
It would be – you don't want to do that.
It would be a really elaborate and weird experiment, and you would eventually have to explain yourself to someone. There is another factor.
What's that?
In the soybean car. We tangentially mentioned it in the beginning here. The anticipation of an upcoming loss of steel resources.
Oh, yeah.
Which Henry Ford, had a spider sense about, did occur. But it was even worse than he imagined, because with the attack on Pearl Harbor in December of 1941, just a few months after the unveiling of the soybean car, the U.S. was drawn into World War II. Domestic auto production, I guess what they say nowadays is pivoted.
Well, it halted, really.
Yeah, it halted.
Well, pivoted, sure. I mean, because they produced other things. It didn't just stop and that's it. Mm-hmm. They produced other things, tanks and airplanes and, any kind of artillery that they needed. It's just it was a different direction for the country at that time. And, of course, all the metal was being, resourced for that effort. So, this would have been perfect timing for them to use this type of material for their bodies after World War II. I don't know why it didn't catch on immediately after World War II.
Well, when the dust settled, it seemed that people had just plumb forgot about it.
Isn't that weird? I mean, just a few years later.
It's weird, but, those were an intense few years.
Well, I guess so. To think back to, two small, we'll just say small appearances. I mean, there were probably very few people in the crowds at these things. I mean, maybe a few hundred at each, maybe at the most.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it would be something that history could easily overlook and then just totally forget about it. And again, it's just lost to the history books because, this car was destroyed. Really, only the people that were there really, told the tale afterwards.
Right.
And for whatever reason, there wasn't a push to bring this back post-war. I just can't get it because the timing would have been just right.
And this leaves us with a couple of questions. Was this plastic really as good as so many of the history books say, or is it being exaggerated?
Could have been extremely expensive at the time to produce.
That's a really good point, too.
That's the other thing. It could have been like the carbon fiber of the day.
Right.
Sure, we can do it, but each panel cost us 10 times or 20 times what it costs to make a steel panel.
It could be something like that. Also, why did the guy who originally lost the project become the one to destroy it? It sounds so easy to ascribe, some sort of sense of vindictiveness to it.
Yeah.
But we don't know. Maybe somebody told him he had to do it, and if it's his job, he had to do it.
Could be, but it's odd that the one guy that was that it was in his hands before, and he couldn't do it, he's the one who's assigned to destroy the thing.
It doesn't. You know what? It doesn't look good. That's what I'll say.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't have. It doesn't have good optics, as they say.
Right. Good. That's the one. And if there was some sort of cover up or conspiracy, then why and who did it and why would it originate? It seems relatively unnecessary. Would it be some shadowy cabal of steel manufacturers?
Yeah, I guess, you know, to me, Ben, I don't know if I buy into the whole conspiracy thing. I just feel like this is just bad timing.
Yeah,
I don't think there's
conspiracy.
In one way, it was perfect timing, and the other way, it was bad timing because they forgot all about it. If it had happened, let's say that all this happened where they revealed the car.
Yeah.
Right after World War II, and of course there's this massive shortage of metal because it had all been used for the war effort.
And there's a post-World War II boom. The age of the auto reaches a new era.
Yeah, it's possible that this could have really taken off at that point, but I guess we'll just never know again. And then when they came back with something, you know, acceptable in the 1980s, I guess maybe 1990s. I don't know when Saturn emerged. I can't remember the exact date because I don't have the note in front of me. But I think it was – I'm going to say early 90s.
Yeah,
but,
it feels early 90s to me.
But right then everybody's like, well, this is a revolutionary idea, but it really wasn't.
Did you know I had two Saturns when I was a kid?
You did?
Yeah.
And we had a few people here who had Saturns. What type did you have?
Let's see. I had – it's a long time ago. It was the Coupe.
Oh, the SE2, is that it? Or SC2? I think it's SC2.
It was the SC2. That's the one. And I got in an accident, wrapped that thing around a tree, and they were really safe. But what they didn't tell you is that, sure, you'll be fine, but that car will be gone.
Well, did its job, I guess, right?
Yeah, it was a life-saving Kleenex versus a tree. And on the same day, I went back. It was close to where I was living at the time, and again, I was a young driver.
Yeah,
and I was just petty enough to, when I realized I was okay, and I got a tow truck out there. I'm mortified. You know, my parents are going to be beyond angry.
Oh, sure, yeah, it's total, right?
Right, it was totaled. So I walked back to our house. I got an axe. I walked back. This is about a mile and a half away each way, and then cut the tree down.
Is that right?
And it cursed it the whole time.
You cut the tree down, yeah. Then you wrap your car around.
Yeah.
That's a good story.
Is it? It makes me look pretty petty and like a bad driver. But I did learn my lesson.
This isn't in somebody's front yard then, obviously. This is like on the side of the road somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So the thing is that technology, though, it does work, and we have a few other hemp-related things that might surprise people because we looked into this. You know, no, it's probably not a hemp car, but there might have been hemp components. But one of the last big twists to the story is that Henry Ford had a deeper philosophical impetus in his creation of these different organic material approaches, like the Spanish moss in the seats. There's a reason for this, and that is something that you, Scott, alluded to a little bit earlier in the show. Henry Ford was a farm boy.
Yeah.
And he was consistently trying to meld agriculture and industry. It was a long-term goal of his, and a lot of people forget that in 1908, he already had something like a hemp car because the first Model Ts could be run off gasoline, or you could get an option to run them off a hemp-based fuel.
A hemp-based fuel. Is that right?
Apparently so.
Now, I know that there are engines that will run on just about anything that will burn, really.
Yeah.
So that must be what this is. But he, for some reason, chose a hemp-based fuel for one of those options. Right?
And then eventually they took that. They just stopped making that because of the way gas was working out economically.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? People are much more likely to use gas or be around a gas station.
Sure. Well, at that time, you probably had to buy gas at, you know, by the gallon in a container. I don't think they had gas pumps at every corner like they do
now. No. But like I think he felt the wind shifting on that.
Yeah, you go into the drugstore and buy 5 gallons of gas in 5 1-gallon containers, maybe, or something that, and you know, probably glass containers.
Do you have the equivalent of like a milkman who comes by your house.
Oh, maybe.
In the wee hours.
Fuel, just, well, there you go. Fuel delivery, like we talked about.
Yeah, we do. There are fuel delivery services.
Mobile fuel delivery. Yeah, so I don't know. It's a strange idea, this hemp-based fuel back in 1908 that he's using for his Model T. It's weird.
And the story doesn't end there because people around the globe are researching ways to use hemp as possibly a fuel source in some places, a construction material, not just for autos.
Yeah. Well, I mean, interior fabric, I guess, for cars would be an easy one. That's an easy one to pick out.
And sure.
Say it's durable. You know, it's inexpensive to create.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of pros, I guess, to the – as you'll hear if you go to, again, any music festival and buy a hemp product, a T-shirt, a purse, a poncho, or whatever you're going to buy.
Right.
Yeah, you'll get the lecture that goes along with it. You know?
I never go to concerts.
Or at least the handout card that, says
– Yeah. I'm just not a concert guy, man.
You're a smart consumer, and here's why.
Yeah, right. So – that concludes our story for now. We do know that there are people who, as we said, are researching the future of hemp. And our story of the misidentified soybean car ends there.
Yeah. So if anybody tells you in the future that that Henry Ford built a hemp car, you can tell them you know the truth. Soybeans.
Soybeans.
Yep. All soybeans. Plastics and soybeans.
Yeah. And I think... still, a very impressive endeavor. We hoped you enjoyed this closer look at one of Henry Ford's many, many strange experiments. And this is actually a little bit less strange than many others. If you would like to learn more about Henry Ford, then we invite you to check out the Stuff You Missed in History Class podcast, starring my co-host Scott. You were the expert on Henry Ford here.
At this point, maybe I am, I suppose. We've talked about him so many times on different podcasts and our podcast.
Mm-hmm.
There's a wealth of information out there about him that we haven't even touched on yet. So I feel like there's so many stories to tell.
And you can also check out all of our other Henry Ford-related podcasts on our website, carstuffshow.com, where you can find every audio podcast we have ever done. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we are CarStuffHSW. And if none of that really is getting you cooking with gas, I'm trying to make a hemp car reference.
Mm, boy, I don't know.
Burning your rope.
I like that. Yeah.
Fine. We'll go with that. If none of that is burning your rope, ladies and gentlemen, you are in luck. You can write to us directly with suggestions for upcoming topics, any inside scoop you have on the legend of the hemp car, or, just the tip you think your fellow listeners should know. We are
CarStuff@HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.